So this morning we're entering the third week of our Angha. And for some of us, this is the first moment of our Angha. So welcome if you're just reaching us in mid-flow here. And we've been exploring this text by Dogen about the Bodhisattva's four something or others. Four methods of guidance. we've knocked off the first three, and we're on to the fourth. Although I wouldn't say knocked off, actually, because these teachings are endlessly, endlessly puzzling. They're endlessly disturbing. They're endlessly reassuring. They keep pointing us in the direction over and over again, which I fantasize was Dogen's intention, of what it means, of what it means to be a human being. And how, as human beings, we encounter the great way, and how we are drawn towards it, awed by it, confused by it. How we feel hopeless about it, how we make up ideas about what it is, on and on and on. This great way that has no real boundaries, no containment, except the containment that we bring to it through the forms of our practice, through our encounters with each other, through the social fabric that Dogen is also pointing us towards. This text was written for his lay students, but of course it's relevant to all of us. And I just want to read the beginning of this section that we just started today and just talk a little bit about that. Identity action means non-difference. It is non-difference from self, non-difference from others. For example, in the human world, the Tathagata took the form of a human being. From this we know that he did the same in other realms. When we know identity and action, when we know identity action, others and self are one. Lute, song, and wine are one with human being, deva, and spirit being. Human being is one with lute, song, and wine. Lute, song, and wine are one with lute, song, and wine. Human being is one with human being. Deva is one with deva. Spirit being is one with spirit being. To understand this is to understand identity action. So what's this being one? What is Dogen pointing us to here? What does the practice continually point us to over and over again? And because I don't understand or read Japanese, I'm always fascinated by the way different translators translate the same things. And so I've been looking at other translations of these passages, hoping for somehow or other that the translations into English by all these well-meaning people who understand Japanese, and particularly Dogen's Japanese, which is 13th century Japanese and Chinese as well, he wrote in both languages using the same kanji, the same ideographs. So they interpret, they're all interpretations, all of these translations are interpretations. And in the other two translations that I have, instead of saying one with, the translators use the phrase make friends with, which I think is really great. Being one with is something that we can maybe enter into as a principle, because I hope everyone here has had some glimmer of this non-separation that Dogen's talking about. This non-separation, this really true identity with everything, nothing getting in the way. George was pointing to this in his talk the other day. Actually, everyone, David's pointed to it. We've all pointed to it. This moment when, no matter what we think is happening, we're already part of some great thing, some great movement of the universe that's so far beyond us that there's no way we can ever know it fully. So this practice is not something where we check off a bunch of boxes and then go, got it. But it's a lifelong exploration of what does it mean when these little glimpses of oneness appear to us? What does it mean for everything else in our life? How do we go forward with that, the openness of seeing a flower, feeling the sunlight come into the room and being touched by it either visually or physically? How do we, when everything drops away, because of course things do drop away, as everyone's been pointing to over and over again, and then unfortunately, or fortunately, because this is just the way it is, we, when things drop away, we pick them up again and pat them on the head and say, oh, I didn't mean it. I really need you. I'm not ready yet to have everything drop away. Everything dropping away is always temporary. Just always temporary, because everything is temporary. I hope this isn't news to you. Everything comes and goes. As George mentioned the other day, the translation of the word Tathagata, which is the way the Buddha referred to himself, it means the one who thus comes and the one who thus goes. Coming and going and coming and going. This is the nature of the self. Then everything is like this, and everything is completely connected. So in this identity action, we're one with everything, and that means that we're one with talking. Like right now, who's giving this talk? I don't think it's me, because I really am not sure what's coming out of my mouth. But, you know, we could say for the sake of convenience, yep, Melissa's giving a talk. Yesterday, David gave a talk, George gave a talk, Bob gave a talk, Diane gave a talk. All the talks were given by specific individuals. But really, there's some recognition, and any one of us who's given a talk knows this, or actually every one of us who's opened our mouths, so that includes everybody, knows that sometimes words come out and we don't know what their origin source is. We don't know where they came from. Sometimes they're really foolish and terrible, and sometimes they're really wonderful and brilliant, compassionate and wise. We tend to favor the latter. but according to this teaching, everything we do is already it. It's already this one thing. So the action orientation, as some of the other translators point us to, is to make friends with it. But how do we make friends with the very thing that we hate? How do we make friends with the very thing that we love? Well, again, the latter seems easier. How do we form a relationship? How do we recognize a relationship that's already present? So this friendliness is just a lovely word for me. I just really, somehow it touches me. And in the 5 minutes I took just now to prepare this talk, I kept thinking over and over again. Of course, I've been preparing for it for 2 weeks in another way for my whole life. But I kept thinking, this phrase kept going through my mind, make friends with, and I didn't know where it was from, but I didn't know what happened after the word with. I just kept saying, there's something that dissolved you in the past, some phrase you once heard. This is me talking to myself. Make friends with something, and some wise person said it, and I just couldn't remember what it was. So the miracle of the internet, it just took a minute to Google, make friends with, and then I thought, maybe it was Hafiz or Kabir or Rumi, so I put all their names in, and lo and behold, there it was, a poem by Rumi. And guess what he had us make friends with in this poem? Make friends with your burning, Rumi says. Whoa. Yes, well, no wonder that touched my heart when I heard it. And then I scrambled to find the poem and actually found it just as Steve put the clappers together. And I came downstairs and sat down. It's from a poem called Moses and the Shepherd. And the poem is really sweet and wonderful, and it's been a favorite one of mine for many, many years. And it's about Moses, the biblical Moses. And Rumi, of course, was a Sufi, a Muslim. But in Sufism, and I suspect in Islam in general, all of the great patriarchs and beings of the Hebrew Bible are considered forerunners of Islam as well, and Moses is. And Moses is often a person who puts his foot in his mouth. He's very arrogant, and he thinks he knows everything. And so I just love him, because I can do that. I've been there. Arrogance is one of the many things, including anger, fear, sadness, the whole list that's part of my repertoire. I suspect it might be true for at least a few of you. I suspect maybe all of us. So there's something about him, and he sees a shepherd praying, and the shepherd's praying wrong. He's talking to God as if God is some little tender, fatherly creature, and the shepherd says, "I'm going to comb your hair, and I'm going to wash your feet, and I'm going to..." And Moses can't stand this, and he comes up to him and says, "We don't pray that way. We do it this way. You're not supposed to talk about God like this. God has no form. What do you think you're doing?" And the shepherd runs off into the desert, all upset. Moses thinks, I showed him, I got him, I showed him the true way. Anyone who thinks they know what the true way is maybe can identify with Moses here. But then, luckily, God gets pissed off at Moses for this. He says, how dare you tell anybody how to worship me? And then in this very beautiful passage, which has always really, really affected me, God scolds Moses the way Moses scolded the shepherd. And I'll see if I can find this one little line about the burning. So this is what God says to Moses. He says, "You have separated me from one of my own. Did you come as a prophet to unite or to sever? I have given each being a separate and unique way of seeing and knowing and saying that knowledge. What seems wrong to you is right for him. What's poison to one is honey to someone else. Purity and impurity, sloth and diligence and worship, these mean nothing to me. I'm apart from all that. Ways of worshiping are not to be ranked as better or worse than one another. Hindus do Hindu things. The Dravidian Muslims in India do what they do. It's all praise and it's all right. It's not me that's glorified in acts of worship. It's the worshipers. I don't hear the words they say. I look inside at the humility, that broken open lowliness. That broken open lowliness is the reality, not the language. Forget phraseology. I want burning. Burning. Be friends with your burning. Burn up your thinking and your forms of expression. Moses, those who pay attention to ways of behaving and speaking are one sort. Lovers who burn are another." So this teaching is so similar to what I understand as Dogen's teaching. Although Dogen, of course, had a lot of ideas about what was right and what was wrong, just like the rest of us, and talks about them endlessly in his writings. At the bottom of everything, he also had been touched by the oneness of everything, by this quality that we all know, that it doesn't matter what we do or say, it doesn't matter who we are, it doesn't matter about the endless conversations we have in our heads where we berate ourselves and judge ourselves, or where we praise ourselves and put ourselves up on pedestals, and we do both because they're really the same thing in the end. It doesn't matter whether we think we're good Zen students, bad Zen students, whether our posture is slumped over, or we have perfect posture like a mountain. It doesn't matter whether we are easily pulled into the peace and joy of samadhi, or whether we're constantly bothered by the thoughts in our heads. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. It's this burning. That's all that matters. The fire of practice, the energy of awakening, is a great, great source of life. So no matter what we think we're doing, we can never really comprehend the whole of it. It's impossible. It's too big. It's too much. All we can know is this little fire that burns inside all of us. So we give it different names. The traditional name is bodhicitta, the heart wisdom, bodhi, wisdom. And citta, it means both mind and heart. And in Chinese, it's shin. And in Japanese, it's kokoro. And it's the same meaning, this center of the being, the cells of the heart everywhere in the body. As we know now scientifically, the whole body burning with a longing to remember that we are indeed one. Identity action is just a way of saying everything is happening together. So part of the way of practice is to recognize this, to, when we put our hands together to bow, it's not just like, oh gosh, now we got to do this, but it's, wow, hands are performing identity action, and bending the body over is performing identity action. Chanting, walking, eating, everything, every single thing is just some tiny little presentation of this whole universe that burns with the yearning to wake up to itself. And we can only participate in it. Thank goodness. I'm so grateful that I can participate in it. Even me, with all my faults, with all my mistakes and difficulties and taking the wrong turns and saying the wrong stuff and every once in a while saying something that maybe is helpful to another person. I don't know. It doesn't make any difference because that bodhicitta is not mine. This great heart mind is not mine. It doesn't belong to me. I want burning, God says to Moses. I want to burn too. I want all of my ideas to burn up so that I can just fully participate. But even that wanting creates a story, a narrative, and prevents me from the thing itself. So all I can do is surrender. That's it. That's my identity action. Just surrendering. By the way, this story of Moses and the shepherd has a happy ending, because Moses is so chastised by God in this dialogue that he goes off and searches for the shepherd to apologize, to say, I'm so sorry. I didn't know what I was doing. I really want you to forgive me. Please go ahead and wash God's feet if you want to. That's fine with me. But here's the thing. He finds the shepherd. He follows all these zigzaggy paths through the desert to find the shepherd. And the shepherd looks at him and says, oh, Moses, what you did to me was just what I needed. I don't know who I am anymore. I am so grateful for your teaching. And this is how it works. We say teachers, students. We say husbands, wives, friends, children. We say Sangha members. We say senior Dharma teacher, practice leader. We say Jiki and Tenzo and Shuso. But all of these are temporary means of dividing the world against itself. The reality is, for me, I can't do this by myself.
So let's go around and share our names. David.
George.
Melissa.
Steve.
Alfred.
Bob.
Steve. Peter.
Liv. Diane.
Lucy.
Todd.
So I invite you to sit comfortably. This is the time for our Dharma dialogue, and a time to offer the gift of yourself to the Sangha by asking questions, by sharing what has arisen in you listening to this talk or as we sit. And so as each person talks, we listen to them with our whole heart, teacher after teacher appearing. So I invite whatever is here.
So the yearning, you know, it's easy to think that that's an obstacle, you know. And so, and it's really just a precious gift, you know, that, and the more we feel it, you know, how fortunate we are to have, you know, really be sensitive to it. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for not being the only one.
There's a general meltdown going on.
Last night, Bob gave a talk about a turtle coming out of his shell. Well, good for you, Bob. You just were leading the parade.
Thank you so much, Ross. I just I identify so much with the burning and not, you know, not knowing how to how to become something that I'm not. And you know, I try to throw my whole heart into doing these activities, and I was noticing this morning as I was so badly damaging some of our forms, how, you know, it all wells up in me, you know, this, oh my God, I just wanna do this and to understand, and I keep making all these mistakes, and I feel bad that I that I'm doing it the wrong way, and I was walking around the Zendo, and I was thinking, well, you know, Steve, what would it be like if you were able to stop making mistakes, or even, you know, if you continued to make mistakes, if you could you know, stop feeling badly about it, you know, would you still be a human being? would you still be able to identify yourself with other human beings? And isn't this the identity action that we're talking about here? You know, this not going away of our humanness and the feelings of, I mean, we have these silly forms, you know, and I often think that the, you know, one of the main reasons why we have all these forms is so that we you know, we don't get them. It's impossible, you know, to go through an entire day without, you know, making mistakes in the forms, I think, for all of us, you know, and we notice, you know, with little enough sleep and everything, you know, it'd be all these emotions come up about making the, you know, the silliest of mistakes, and we really, you know, get to feel them in a controlled way in the Zendo, and I think, wow, you know, this is what it's like to be a human being. And then I think, well, yeah, but I already have noticed that a few times, and I really would like to, you know, just like notice two, maybe three times, and then I got it. You know, I'm okay. I'm cool with that. You know, I don't want to continue on, you know, feeling this way that I feel. You know, I don't. I would like to, you know, I want to be able to relate to it and remember it, but I don't want to keep doing this day after day for the rest of my life. But, you know, what am I saying? Am I saying I don't want to be a human being anymore? You know, I want to be some grand perfect. You know, good luck. You know, that ain't gonna happen to me. You know? So maybe even this, you know, feeling bad is a seed of compassion.
It's certainly a gift of compassion to me, Steve, because it makes me feel not quite so stupid when I mess up. You know, I think how awful it would be if anybody really was perfect. I mean, they'd be insufferable.
Actually, before you say something, I just suddenly had this. I just want to insert, and the longing to be perfect is part of it too. You know, that it is almost a setup. You know, this stuff is really made up. This is, human beings are great at making stuff up, so we make up all these forms, and we say, well, we had heard it. You know, that our friend Dosha Port loves to say, well, this is Dogen's true way. You know, bow like this. How does he know? And he knows, he's joking. He's joking. But it's Dogen made it up, and the people before him made it up, and everybody made it up. And that's great. And yet there's this longing to be perfect. And the longing to be perfect, I think, is part of what, you know, you can also make friends with that. Yeah.
I just love that story, or is it, the whole thing is the Rumi poem, right? But that you know, that what we're so sure is a mistake turns out to be exactly what somebody needs, or what we need, or you know, and from that view of everything arising together, there's no mistake, but everything has these ramifications that we can't begin to comprehend.
Yeah, it's interesting. That poem came, the story part of it came up to me a couple of times last week as we were sitting, and just loving that, you know, because we have logistics meetings where we talk about, well, do the clappers come here? Do we bow then? Is it, you know, and it's kind of endless. And this lovely, you know, all mistakes and no mistakes, and the possibility of that. Yeah. Derek and then...
Oh, actually, that's what I was going to say.
Word for word. You guys should stop sitting in stage. Sorry, Derek.
Okay, Christine.
I really resonated with the words, and it gives me a new perspective. To make friends of my feeling broken, open, and lonely. And as I go through my travels and do my best to keep to see all the world as Zen, I feel very broken, open, and lonely. And I don't know who I am anymore. And what I realize in coming here before I go on another trip again is that I can make friends with that instead of resisting. So, thank you.
Make friends with the not knowing who you are?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the feeling broken, open, and lonely.
Yeah.
Well, and then it's, I think we're constantly invited, and Dogen does this with language, and, you know, it happens on the cushion. Things need to get turned upside down and scrambled, and that this teaching that the problem is not the problem, you know, the mistake is not the mistake, the loot is not the loot, you are not you, that's where, in that very place that we resist more than anything, I do not want to be lonely, I do, you know, whatever, that you know, how could the world be constructed this way, that when we go in to the fire, when we burn, what happens is so great aliveness and something beyond even what we thought we were yearning for. Yeah, some possibility.
It's when you said, I don't know who I am anymore, I thought this whole... my body just had the shiver all over it. I felt it come awake in the
world. I was thinking, Liz, as you're talking about the burning, that actually we are burning. Human beings, oxygen coming in, and every cell is burning. You know, we're oxidizing. Each one of us truly a flame. You know, not even metaphorically.
That's true.
Yeah, right? It is. Yeah.
Yeah, that's the big difference when you hang out with a dead body. That it's not a flame. It's cold and still.
Yeah, not oxidizing.
Yeah, it's not alive. Yeah, with that burning. I never thought.
Thinking about what Steve was saying, and one thing I like about this practice is, and I think about this in the Prajnaparamita, is that the practice is very reassuring in that what I take away from it is that you're told that you're going to have glimmers of insight, but then you're going to go back to being a crude human being, and it's going to go back and forth like that. So, you know, and I was thinking about in your example, you know, you might be locked in. You might think that as you're doing walking meditation, and you think, I've really got the groove now, and all of a sudden you trip over the threshold, and that just happens. You know, it's gonna continue to happen. I mean, this the quest for perfection is not gonna happen.
Yeah.
You know, and I find, and in these, like I was saying, the Prajnaparamita, when they talk about form is emptiness and emptiness is form. You know, that's that. Going back and forth, I think, between the between those two states that I reflect on.
And that as we go back and forth, the teaching is also that form is emptiness.
Right, right.
And emptiness is form, and enlightenment is delusion, and delusion, and so it really gets...
That's too mind-blowing, yeah. I like to keep it so.
Well, because you know what happens when those two elements come together. Boom! You know, right? There is an explosion of life and energy, and we would rather just that you're in good company. And that is part of the work of Zen anyway, I believe, is teaching us to practice through meetings, through listening to talks and study and discussion, to begin to tolerate that combustion. You know, that so that we can actually, when it happens, it'll be welcome rather than, oh no, where's the rubber room?
Third floor. I'm at second floor. I didn't really.
No, it's the third floor. Oh, we weren't supposed to
say. We have lots of beds.
Lots of beds. The rubber room
is there.
I'm just amazed at how
much my mind goes. I'm sitting here playing Mukugyo and reciting this chant from memory, and my mind is still on top of that, like judging where to hit, like this sounds better, that sounds worse, and like just thinking about how I'm doing all this stuff from memory and then snapping back to just playing Mukugyo and chanting. It's crazy.
Yeah.
Talking about being human, right? It's crazy.
Well, and you know, a big part of that, what you're discovering for yourself, how complex this whole thing is, that there's some stuff in consciousness, very little is in consciousness, and there's a lot of stuff that's being taken care of. You know, we were talking about that research. I can't remember if you were here when we were talking about it, that, you know, we move and then we make up a story about it. You know, that there is just this, we're participating in this whole thing. It's like if you're driving a car, more complicated even than playing the Mukugyo. You know, you don't think, all right, now I'm going to step on, no, wait, the clutch. I'm going to do the clutch because then I need to, you know, so we'd be like, we'd be in an accident in no time. But it you know, but when we're 16 years old, 15 years old, we have to learn those steps, and then we can do it. And then it's just smooth functioning. But you can be so appreciative of all the things we don't have to be thinking about. Like, you know, you could also be sitting there doing the Mukugyo, reciting the chant, thinking about where to hit it, try to beat your heart, get your kidney to function, do some liver stuff, digest some food, you know, get right. But you, thank goodness, you don't have to do that. But we do. We want to. Too. That's the other side of it. So I appreciate that observation. It's just so rich, this life.
So as I was walking in the Zendo and I was having this idea of all these mistakes that I was making and how, you know, feeling bad about them was so human. And then suddenly these words came up from the Qin Shi Ming about, you know, the great way is not difficult for those who pick and choose, you know. And I was thinking about, you know, I'm always picking and choosing and I'm always being confronted with difficulties, and yet there really is this not difficult quality to it all, you know. And how strange that is, that it can be both nothing other than difficulty and picking and choosing and being human, and also in some strange way it can be not difficult at all.
Thank you for that.